Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hello, listeners. Thanks for listening to the Global Marketing Podcast. And I'm very excited to welcome Krista Casas today. She's a very strong woman intellectually, emotionally, and physically. She's a business founder. She's a vet, a firefighter, strength trainer, and global business executive right now. So welcome, Krista.
Thank you. Wow, that was quite the introduction.
I know. And now I've been saving up a question to ask you.
What's that?
The most you've ever benched.
Oh my God.
I know you can bench more than a lot of guys. You mentioned that.
That was back in the day. I think I did maybe 145, but that was, you know, I wasn't doing it for strength training as much as just, you know, bodybuilding, which, so it's not impressive compared to some women that are actual, you know, strength athletes.
Okay, so you were doing it for the bodybuilding, so it's also more precise and geared at certain muscles.
Exactly, and not really focused on how much can you actually, you know, bench. But yeah, I had that little tiny, you know, tiny little record.
Well, it impresses me. All right, so let's start out. Can you tell me about the first exposure you had to another language or culture?
Grew up in a Mexican-American family, or rather, I was the Mexican-American. I'm a first-generation American. My parents are from Mexico, so, I mean, the first interaction is, of course, in my own household. I grew up speaking both English and Spanish. I don't know which one is my mother language, since I learned to speak them both at the same time. But at the same time, like, if we talk about culture outside of that initial, you know, home culture, I traveled a lot with my parents when I was young. They were missionaries and they homeschooled me before, you know, it was cool in the 2020 way.
Forced.
All of the forced ways. But yeah, they did it so that I could travel with them. And so I got exposed, you know, there's Mexican culture and then there's the rest of Latin America and Hispanic world. So I traveled to Nicaragua and Panama and Costa Rica. And so every country has its own different culture, and even though they speak Spanish, it's always a different variation of Spanish and different sayings and so many different things even within the same language across countries.
Can you give me some examples of what were some of the differences you remember experiencing?
Oh my goodness. I think one of them was So in Spanish, like somebody that's light-skinned or fair-skinned, in Mexico at least, we call them a güero. And maybe you've heard the term, you know, like Americans getting called güeros in Mexico, right? Well, when we were in Nicaragua, my mom, I think she saw this little boy and she said, oh, qué lindo, mira qué güerito. Like how he's so cute, like fair skinned. It's supposed to be like or it was at least back in the 90s. It was like a little affectionate. And the mom just looked at my mom horrified. And my mom's like, what? I thought that was a compliment, right? And apparently that term is more, I think, and I should probably go verify this, but from what I remember, it's a term towards like rotten eggs in that place. And so my mom was like, okay, then not all Spanish is created equal and should probably not use slang terms out here.
Oh, isn't that funny? Yeah.
It took some explanation.
Right. So that is completely, they were both Spanish, but the culture really affected the language there.
Right. Slang. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So you moved. So you're here, you are bilingual English, Spanish, and you're moving to a bunch of different countries. Do you remember having fears about going to the other countries, or were you young enough to not have that?
I mean, I think, I'm trying to think about like, what are my memories like, and what do they feel like, right? Trying to go back to those. I mean, we started traveling when I was very young, you know, 4 or 5 years old, into northern Mexico and then into the, so to be honest, I never went to a tourist place in Mexico like Cancun or Puerto Vallarta or anything like that until I was about 28, 29 years old. So wow. All the places that we went to were either deep in the Sierra, in the Mexican mountains with the indigenous communities, or in very impoverished areas. So I got to experience a different Mexico than any typical American vacationing in that country would. And at the same time, I think just my parents always thought about, you know, what the mission was to go help these communities, help build schools, bring supplies, whatever that may be. Never really felt like there was a fear of anything. There was always precautions. We obviously knew what the status of you know, what the safety was like and the road conditions. And we did have a few encounters where we managed to escape almost getting, you know, kidnapped on a roadside. But it was never, yeah, but, and I was young and it was almost always like an adventure, right? It was an eye-opening adventure into just, this is, my father used to always say, this is reality. This is the world we live in. We can't shelter our kids from reality. And I think it made me a stronger person.
Yeah. Okay. So then where did you go to high school?
I was homeschooled all the way through. My mom was actually, she still is, bless her soul, she's in her 70s and still teaching high school in Houston, Texas. So she's been a high school teacher her whole life. She's taught French and Spanish. And so I should probably go check the validity of what I'm saying now, but back then if you had a parent that was, you know, a certified teacher or something like that, licensed teacher, they could teach you all the way through. And so I was homeschooled my whole life.
And where were you living then?
Let's see. So I grew up in a little tiny town called Lexington, Texas. And then of course traveled throughout Mexico most of my childhood. Then we lived for 3 years in Mexico and different parts of like central Mexico, San Luis Potosí, Veracruz on the coast, on the Atlantic coast, and Querétaro. And then after around 15 years old, I moved to California, and I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area up until I was 18. Well, actually, I lie. I mean, that's when I finished when I finished high school, right? But then I continued living in the Bay Area a total of 14 years. And
because you went on to UC Berkeley then, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So your mom did a good job training you.
Yes. I think that she was a very, very disciplinarian, very, very, she was a tough teacher. If I deserved an F or a B or a C, she had no qualms about it and she gave it to me.
Wow. Okay. So you get into UC Berkeley, you go through the, you know, and you major in poli sci, and then you get out, and that's when you went into the military?
No, actually. So I joined the Marine Corps Reserves. And so in the reserves, under normal circumstances, you can still have your regular civilian job or go to college or whatever your day schedule is like. And then they call it a weekend a month, and 2 weeks in the summer, you do your military duty. You go through a series of annual trainings that you're supposed to accomplish every year. But then, of course, it just means that you still have to go through all the basic training. You still go through boot camp, through combat training, and through your specialty school, and then you go to college or go back to work or your family or whatever that may be. Then you go into your reserve duty of the weekend a month and 2 weeks in the summer. And then, of course, throughout your whole enlistment, you're eligible to get deployed or activated for whatever kind of, whatever the country needs, whether it's a deployment overseas to go to war, or whether it's for training or anything like that.
Okay, so you went to a trucking. Okay, so you joined the reserves.
So I went to the Marine Corps. Yeah, I joined the reserves. I went through boot camp on my training. I also went to UC Berkeley at the same time. I was deployed to Iraq. My undergrads went to Iraq, came back a year later, and
you faded out for a minute. So let's ask that again. So you joined the Marine Corps reserves while mm-hmm. you were at UC Berkeley.
Yes. So okay. I did my training over the summer of 2005, and then after my training, I went to start my first year at UC Berkeley. I did 3 years of that, and then I got deployed overseas to Iraq. Came back in 2009 and started my senior year.
Okay, so tell me now, because you have you grew up in a Mexican American family. You went to a lot of Spanish-speaking companies, so Iraq was really the first country you had been to, right? That you didn't speak the language?
I mean, I went to Thailand for training a year prior, and then, I'm trying to think. I mean, I've been to Spain as well before that while I was a teenager, but as far as foreign language, I think, you know, Thailand was one of them. And then Iraq, of course, it was the next one.
Okay, so tell me what it's like to be a bilingual person, gone to all these countries, and now all of a sudden you're in countries where you don't speak the language. How did you go about managing that?
You know, I think that you realize that once there's a language barrier, that how your mannerisms, your motions with your hands, with your face, your smile, how you look at things, you know, all of a sudden everything else starts mattering more, right? It's almost like when they talk about the five senses, if one goes down, like, if, you know, the other ones mm-hmm. become more heightened, right? So for me, I've learned to, you know, before the Google Translate days, you know, I learned that's, you know, using your hands, trying to communicate through gestures, and also almost like building some kind of trust and confidence in an unspoken manner, goes a long way.
Okay. So all right. Now you mentioned Google Translate. I gotta have you talk about that because you're bilingual, so you know the pluses and minuses about it.
Oh God!
Yeah, tell me about that.
I don't trust it, but it goes a long way.
It's a good way to say it.
I call it a necessary evil. I think it does more good than bad, but it's almost like, you know, you hope for the best, you do the little Google Translate, and then look at the person's face to see if they're going to laugh at you or if they understand. and you hope that is one of those two and not a look of horror about like, what did you just tell me?
Yes, exactly. Just like your mom got the, you know, the look of horror about the little boy because there was a cultural difference. You could get that exactly. same look with Google Translate. Yeah. So tell me about an experience that you had with Google Translate where it worked really well or it didn't work.
Okay. Well, I have Let's see. I went to Thailand a second time, and now this was in Christmas time in 2018. So almost 11 years later, and I had like it was like this eat, pray, love trip. I'm like, I'm gonna eat a lot of good food. I'm gonna visit all the temples. It was just like one of those like spiritual re-encounter with yourself trips. And I just wanted to really experience culture and spirituality. And so most people who've seen my pictures will know I have tattoos. And so there was this one tattoo that I wanted to get, and I was trying to not do like the Angelina Jolie tourist thing, right? Yeah. And so I did so much research about where to find this. There are these tattoos that are made by these Buddhist monks, and they use like an old style. And I found the original temple, and it was probably about a 2-hour trip outside Bangkok. And so it was Christmas, had a flight to catch at 2 a.m. And so it was like about 3 p.m. and I missed the bus. So I realized I have to get a taxi driver. But so I get to the taxi stand, and in my imagination, I'm thinking like, okay, so like everyone who is planning a trip to Thailand, kind of, if they're interested in tattoos, which I thought was a big thing, was they know about this temple. And so when I told the taxi stand guy, I'm like, I'm trying to go to this temple. He just looks at me like, I don't know. Do you know how many temples we have? Like, and so he's like, how far away is it? And then I open Google Maps, of course, and like, it's over here. And he says, oh no, like you're not going to find anyone. And he spoke some broken English. And he told me basically I was kind of screwed. But he says, let's go out to the taxi drivers and see who's willing to go that far, right? And it's 3 p.m. We're about to hit rush hour. And he goes taxi driver after taxi driver all the way down the line. He's translating. And then they're all laughing. And I'm like, I don't even know what they're saying. I feel like I just asked for something ridiculous. And so finally he finds one taxi driver that's willing to go the way. And of course, Google said about 2 hours. So I needed to get there before 6 p.m. when the monks would I guess shut down the tattooing or the prayers and everything. Yeah. So we get in the taxi, and I decide I never trust taxi drivers or transportation. That's one of my little, you know, how to manage risk on my own. So even if I'm getting an Uber ride, I always open my own Google Maps to make sure that they're still going the route that I expect them to. And so I open Google Maps for the route, and I also open my Google Translate, and I try to start having this conversation with this guy. And needless to say, he did not follow the Google Maps route, because he had his own ideas of which ways he should take, which of course was where there was accidents and traffic and everything. And so I spent hours trying to tell him, no, like, go this way because it's much better, because Google Maps says so. I know you've been driving in Bangkok for, I don't know, 30 years, but Google Maps says this. And so we tried communicating this over and over. And I don't know if he just had never used Google Maps or what was going on, but he just didn't understand that this digital map on my phone would be smarter than all his taxi driving experience. This drive ended up into the middle of the night. I barely made it back to the airport on time. But along the way, between Google Translate and hand signals and a lot of laughs about my ridiculous idea of going to get a tattoo, what turned into like 4 hours away from Bangkok, we turned into great friends. We stopped at a little 7-Eleven. He bought me coffee, and then he looks at me and he just makes, you know, hand signals, like asking me if I want to eat, and like, long day. And I'm like, yes, I'm hungry. It's been a long day. And took me to a little like food stand along the way, had some great rice and curry. And this guy at the end of the night, you know, was playing Christmas music. We were driving to the airport, and he was just a happy dude. And I just remember, like, wow, Google Translate in the end did its job. You know, it was complicated to get to it, but he eventually understood that technology had something, you know, to give. And I realized that it wasn't all about technology. So it was about, you know, trying to get to know someone and in other ways as well.
So he's driving the car and you're using Google Translate by voice?
Yes. I think so. Yeah. I would just like,
because you could type it in and get right. The reply.
Right.
I can. Then he'd have to read it.
He would sometimes either read it or I would have the, but I'm telling you, Google Voice does not have the best pronunciation of things.
I can't even imagine how you were able to facilitate while he's driving and reading and you're typing and then he's trying to respond, right?
Yeah, well, that was the other thing, was the response, right? So he wouldn't be able to type in his response for me to get the translation or anything like that. So I had to learn how to ask like yes, no questions or questions that could be answered with gestures, right? It wasn't like I couldn't expect a big story, right? So trying to get to know him, like, do you have family? Yes. Wife? Yes.
You have kids. You got to know a lot about,
you know, hand signals and like, yeah. And so you realize that. Things as the American girl from, you know, trying to go get an Angelina Jolie Sofiane tattoo on Christmas Eve, sorry. And so that's another long story, but yeah, it was a great experience. I you know, I realized there's more to getting to know people than just, we take it for granted just having a conversation like you and I are right now. Yeah. And when you're in front of all these other languages, it's not just words, it's not just the translation of words, it's the culture of the words, it's how the person uses them, it's trying to understand tone and so many other things around their words.
Do you think that Google Translate or any machine translation will ever get there?
I think it will. I mean, AI is just amazing, and the advances that are, and I'm sure there's something out there that does, you know, but I think we'll get there. But I think at the same time, the human element can never be replaced.
That's what I'm seeing, is you can never capture that, like the experience that your mom had. I mean, imagine right. How many different Spanishes and culture, and then the new words that are added in.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I mean, I say I speak Spanish, but I think the last time that I went to Mexico and spoke with my cousins, I realized I was missing a lot of slang because my mother was very, very obstinate about teaching me proper Spanish, proper English. So I speak, like, you know, I speak very proper Spanish. And so when I go down there, like the slang has evolved so much, even with texting, it's ridiculous. Like I'll read a text and I'm like, this isn't Spanish.
I think we say that about English too.
Probably, right? LOL, IRL.
LOL, and yeah, exactly. So oftentimes people will say English is the global language. You've been to enough countries now. What would you say about that?
Yes and no. I have a lot of opinions on that one.
Go, you get a full platform to air them.
It's a very sad thing, I think, that we Americans take that statement for granted and expect everybody else in the world to understand us. And so we go to other countries and we ask, you know, do you speak English? And we hope that they speak English. And I think what that's created is it's created a culture of entitlement, a language entitlement almost, to where we expect that wherever in the world we go, someone's going to speak English. And we never stop to think, what should we try to do to be respectful of their culture or to travel to their land? And, you know, I mean, I think we do it a lot here in the US. Some people might say, oh, why, if people immigrate into the US, they should speak English, right? Mm-hmm. And so why don't we have that same mentality when we go to other people's, you know, countries? I think some people might pick up one of those little traveling books and try to learn some phrases, which is fantastic. But more often than not, I see that just people hope that others speak English. And, you know, it, a lot of people in this world speak English. Yes, they do. But that's because they know five languages. You know, and it's amazing. For example, in Ghana, a kid will speak 5 to 7 languages because they speak if they're, depending on what city they are, what part of Ghana they are, they'll speak like the Twi, which is just the language there. But then there's all the dialects, you know, where's mom from, where's dad from, what dialects do they speak? And then they'll speak English as well. And then they might even speak some French because, you know, you have Togo and Cote d'Ivoire and other countries in the area that are, were French dominated. So I would say there's three main languages, you know, if I don't consider like, you know, the big Asian, you know, China and Japan, right? And even, well, no, I'm going to take India out of that one. So when I look at the countries, when we look at colonialized countries, right? Sometimes people don't think about, well, I'm going to South Africa or, right, for example, or I'm going to Mozambique. Well, yes, it's an African country, but, you know, what languages were there before and what languages are currently spoken, right? Who invaded those countries and who were the colonizers? And sometimes it was a series of colonizers. You would have, you know, the Portuguese and then the Brits and then, you know, then Africans was developed, right? It's in its own language. And then there's also the local dialect. So yes and no, I think that English is definitely, you know, a language that is spoken in a lot parts of the world, but I don't like the attitude about it.
Right. And so there's an attitude, that attitude goes across, particularly in tourism.
Right.
And I guess with business and speaking. And do you think a business can get by with doing their marketing or outreach in English? Are they going to pull people in?
It depends on the country, right? It depends on the country. And it also depends on what you're marketing, I think. I think that there is a lot of things that, you know, that are part of like that American pop culture that certain generations might be attracted to. It's like, oh, that's, you know, that's American or that's British or that's Western, right? So they might be attracted to the big Netflix logo being, you know, in big English Netflix, you know, red words. But at the end of the day, you know, the company wouldn't survive in India if they didn't bring on, you know, local films and local flicks, right? So you still have to localize in a lot of ways. And depending on your product as well, you got to realize that even if you do come into a country that does have a, you know, majority English speaking population, that not all parts of the country will have that English education. Or it could be a predominantly French speaking country or Portuguese or Chinese, whatever it may be. So I think that any company that is looking to go overseas, one of the very first things that they need to be considering is what is the culture like and how is that going to affect my product and therefore how is that going to affect my marketing.
Okay. And so how's the culture going to affect my marketing, and does it need to be done in the local language or could I get away with it in English?
Right.
But there's so many more considerations to that.
There's a lot of considerations. I mean, even if they speak English, what is the sentiment towards anything Western? You know, yeah. Is there an anti-Western sentiment or is it better if you localize and in what dialect or there's just so many considerations. So I would say maybe your brand name stays in English, right? But realize that if you go to Thailand or any other, you know, country or India or anything like that, then the Latin script, that you're gonna even have to maybe translate your logo into that script for it to be understood. It could even still be saying Netflix. It might just have to be, you know, scripted differently.
Right. So what recommendations would you give for a company that wants to expand internationally? Well, actually, before we get into that, because I want to come back to recommendations, but you mentioned Ghana, and you did a lot of humanitarian work in Ghana. I'd love for you to talk about that. Because that's very interesting. and what you learned for cross-cultural and cross-lingual communications.
Right. Well, I'll clarify that my work in Ghana wasn't directly humanitarian. I have done a lot of humanitarian work, but in Ghana specifically, I was working for a startup that uses drones to deliver blood and medicine, and now with COVID-19, other critical medical supplies. So I guess the mission of the company can sound humanitarian, but it's still a for-profit.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So I always want to make sure that I clarify that portion, because I was still making money. So that takes away part of the humanitarian portion of it, right?
Okay. So you did your humanitarian work more in Haiti?
No, in the nonprofit sector with in Team Rubicon, Ecuador, Mexico, and a lot of work throughout across the U.S. doing disaster response. That's where the, if you want to call it humanitarian work, that's where that came in. But in Ghana, it was So in Ghana, it was integrating what I like to call tech for good. So, which I'm a huge fan of, and my company promotes right now. It's technology that is doing good and is helping, you know, advance sustainable development goals around the world. So culture, oh my gosh, culture. You might think that implementing technology is pretty straightforward, in the sense of, okay, you need engineers, you need people who can operate the product, whatever that may be. The whole thing there, and one of the reasons why I started my company is that culture and local know-how can affect so much how well a product is launched in a specific country, that it cannot be overlooked. So what me and my team did there was launching distribution centers for the drones, and so it meant building facilities and facilities that were both airspace compliant and also medically compliant, because it was a very complicated product.
What were your biggest challenges in doing that?
So getting to know, I think quality with construction and being able to translate, you know, American or international quality standards, especially when it comes to like medical facilities. So being able to translate those quality standards and the needs for that quality into a local construction company, right? Or trying to get them to be able to build to that standard.
When you say translation, is that in language translation, or is that translating it, like more general use of the term of expectation, setting expectations?
Actually, I would say both. You know, we're lucky that there's a lot of international standards already set in place. Mm-hmm. And of course that there were a large population of English speaking individuals. I mean, the CEO, the general manager, and most of like the engineering managers and construction managers spoke English, as well as some of the workers and the laborers. But the thing was that, you know, once we're talking about, when I mean translating that quality product is quality in one country can mean something different than quality in country B, right? And so they'll say, this is high quality. And yes, it is. It is high quality by those standards. It's high quality by what they're used to. But then we're coming in and saying, well, we need this high quality plus this extra type of, you know, medical grade or medical standards or certain engineering standards that now not only do we have to translate, but we also, and maybe the managers understand it, but getting that to the laborers and to the workforce to understand the importance of having that quality standard is huge. And I remember that when I finally felt like we had a breakthrough, and that was, and this is not to, you know, harp on any culture or anything, but But I think this is important whether you're dealing with American laborers or Ghanaian or French or wherever in the world you are. And so we were trying to finish the project, and we were behind on some deadlines, and it was just getting very difficult to motivate the workforce to get to where we needed them to get, right, on time. Mm-hmm. And so I asked one of the managers, the construction managers, I'm like, do they know what they're building? And he said, I don't know. I don't think we've ever explained to them what this building is, right, or what it's supposed to service, right? Yeah. So they just had their instructions. Okay, you know, you have this wall or this ditch or this whatever. And I said, well, do you mind if I have one of my Ghanaian engineers speak to them in their local language, show them a video of what this building is going to really do, which is launch drones and be like a distribution facility for vaccines and medical supplies for their community and life-saving blood. And he says, well, sure, you can do that. Like, kind of unsure about, like, what's that going to really do, right? Yeah. And so I had the engineer get them all together, and he, you know, told these 80 guys in Chui, like, this is what we're doing here. And he basically explained it in their language, and meant their facial expressions, their demeanor changed. I almost felt like people started standing a little taller, like, I'm building something for my community, right? Something that's going to bring good to my community and help potentially a family member, right? And when they realized that this was the first of its kind type of building in the whole country, it brought a sense of pride to them that they were building something that was going to be a national undertaking. And I mean, I'm not saying that's what helped us hit the deadlines, but it changed.
Oh, it sounds like it really helped if they stood up and were proud. Yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's language went along in that way, and being able to translate mission and goals went a long way as well.
Okay, so really, you, even though people might have spoken some English, to really pull in the translation in the local language to set a vision.
Right, right. And even if you can, again, going back to, you can translate, you can do word for word, but to have somebody that was from their own, you know, their own community, their own culture, that understood the technology, that understood what the goals were, and was passionate about it as well, went a long way.
So it's real important on who you pick to do it. It's not just getting it done, but picking.
Oh, absolutely. We go back, in the culture aside or country aside, and that just goes back to great, you know, organizational management and management of your human capital.
So you have worked in so many different countries. Tell us about what you're doing now.
Right. Well, it is about time to try and kind of pursue something that not only was I very passionate about, but it's mine in the end. And so I think you keep on mentioning, you know, all these different things that I've done in my life, and the reality is that they're all interconnected by one thing, and that is that I've been very passionate about every single one of them. So every single job that I've done, I've really loved what I've done. And looking back, it was all pretty much a lot of internal consulting for all those companies that I was working for, whether it was a nonprofit, whether it was a startup, or whether it was a corporate business. A lot of it was fixing the organizational structure, process, or whatever that may be. COVID-19 hit, you know, a lot of global people lost their jobs in this pandemic. And so I was overseas 100% of the time and had to come back. And so I decided to launch my own company. I hate to call it a consulting firm because there's so many of them. And consulting comes in, and a lot of times, you know, it tells you what's the best way to do things and then leaves you to it, lets you decide whether you pursue that advice or not. So I decided to take what I was most passionate about and start and offer it to other tech companies. So I pulled together a few other former coworkers that I really trusted and that I loved working with, two other power women that have worked in, you know, nonprofit, humanitarian work, operations, logistics, supply chain. You know, I'm talking, you know, very, very strong women that have worked in unlikely situations, unlikely roles for women, and succeeded in them, and have supported even me in previous jobs and in my own roles. And so I thought, I don't want to go at it alone. I don't want to start my own business on my own. I want to have a phenomenal support network, and I want to have somebody that's that understands my mission and my passion and that I can bounce ideas off of. And so I was very, very lucky to have my two co-founders, Marina Yang and Erica Duran, join me into starting this company. So our goal
is to help.
So what
are you offering your clients?
So we are offering operation solutions for tech startups that are looking to expand into foreign markets. So we're looking for tech companies that are creating a product that is going, what we call it, like, for good, right? So it's going to advance sustainable development goals. And for example, drones, we're not looking into surveillance drones. We want drones that would deliver medical aid or help a local economy. Ed tech that might, you know, give access to kids that would normally not have access to higher education in certain parts of India. So how do you start? So say
you start a project with one of them, and you know they've got the technology starting up, and you know they have the global going. How do you start? Because that business owner has so many balls in the air right now.
Right. And that's, I mean, we can start at different stages. We can start at the business strategy, like, great, so you're thinking about going global. We can help you, you know, develop the right strategy for that. Or they've already decided to go global, right? And so we look at what countries they've already considering. And then we go to, we call vetting that market to make sure it's actually, you know, to make sure that we can see around the corners and that we understand what challenges might come up to enter that market, especially from an operations and tech implementation standpoint. So, for example, you have a great product A, but it requires certain kind of fiber or Wi-Fi, or it might require 2G or 3G to operate. And so maybe that's overlooked in the process of, you know, we want to enter this country. So that's a lot of what we do. We bring our operational know-how and our technological know-how and combine it with business strategy to help companies, you know, make these decisions in a more operations focused manner than just than would normally be done. Especially we're focusing on tech startups, especially because a lot of times you look at tech startups, they're very, very engineering heavy. You know, they have a lot of, you know, software engineers, mechanical engineers, whatever they're using to develop their product. And sometimes, you know, the business person with cultural know-how comes in way, you know, down the line when they finally have the budget to hire that. Or they might not be thinking about, I need somebody that has expertise in the Indian market to tell me if I can even, you know, promise to develop this product for the Indian market. And so we want to come in and be able to help these companies achieve that and understand, you know, that there's this intersect between business and operations that needs to be considered a lot earlier, even in the development of the product, than is norm, right? And so yes, we can come into a lot of different stages, and where do we start? It starts like with my taxi driver. Start to get to know the person. Get to know the person, get to know the product, get to know the company. And it's not just like, oh, so you have a product that, you know, has these capabilities. It's like getting to know their mission and what drives them and what is the CEO's goal, the founder's goal, what do they really want to achieve in the world? Or, you know, what's the company culture and is it going to fit in the country culture, right? So yeah. So a lot of those things that can get lost in translation, okay, are so things sounds, we care about.
Yeah, it sounds like you can come in and help them develop a strategy of where the products go, like doing that deep dive analysis and getting them set up. or if they've done that and said, we're targeting Nigeria, you can come in and vet it and go even deeper than the strategy does and say, well, this is problem areas, this is what's going to work. Or you can come in and they're saying, yeah, we know we got to go global quickly, and you can bring the cultural know-how and a structure and a framework to think about that.
Right.
That could help guide them as to what specific.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And one of the other things that we want to point out is that we want to do this in an ethical manner. And so there's a lot, especially in a lot of developing countries where ethical business is difficult to conduct, or you think you're conducting ethical business, but you don't realize that, you know, the third party contractor that you hire to help you with this procedure is paying, you know, an official under the table. And so knowing what the procedure is, what the local culture is like, and even, you know, understanding, you know, corruption can be so ingrained that it's okay. You know, it's not a bad thing. And so understanding what are all the different nuances between varying from one culture to the other and how to deal with them so that a company can conduct business ethically is a big thing. Knowing that wherever you're sourcing your supply chain from is producing that whatever, you know, your product in an ethical manner, with the right labor laws, you know, with the right, you know, just ensuring that it's not just what you in your Silicon Valley, you know, manufacturing place are doing, but also going up the supply chain and where you're sourcing your products from, and knowing your sources and having alternatives, and ensuring that your whole process up and down the chain is ethical and it's doing things for the right reason.
What are the biggest mistakes a company like that could make, either ethical or strategy or any of the areas that you've seen across your experience?
So on the ethical side, I think that again, and actually on the two biggest things that we harp on is ethics and the strategy of, does your product actually fit the country's needs? Those are things that get considered process. That's one thing that a lot of times we are too focused on developing a product or the engineering part of it, and we don't really think about how is this going to develop in a different economy or in a different market or the intended place. So it's difficult because unless you have local knowledge, or you have somebody that's been to that country and dealt with those situations, or you've hired people that you trust, fixers that you trust, or people that you trust, contractors that you trust in that country, that they're going to conduct ethical business for you, right? That's a big thing. So relationships and trust and vetting go a very, very long way. And those are things that a company needs to consider early on. My biggest thing would be, you know, I think that sometimes PR, marketing, and salespeople can get ahead of the engineering and the operations. And that's one thing. You got to make sure that all your different teams and sections are clear on, you know, the salespeople understand, you know, it's sales job is, and business development, it's like their job is to sell the product, right? Get the contracts in the door, right? But realizing that you can get contracts in the door, you can get sales in the door, you can close those deals. But if then your engineering department doesn't have the product ready, or their supply chain is lagging, or there's an issue with production and manufacturing, then so these two departments need to be talking to each other and be realistic about the expectations. Or if business development is looking into, I'm just going to throw, Haiti, right, to develop this product or to enter this product into the market with this product. Do the engineers know that the sales team wants to go into Haiti? Because can the infrastructure in Haiti support the product? Yeah. Right. And so these are things that sometimes there can be some segregation of information amongst companies. And so it's important that we don't get siloed into that kind of information, and that all teams are bought into certain moves, right?
That seems like that's one of your skills, is being able to pull people together and get them to talk.
I try.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that what you'd say one of your strengths is?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I've been working with developing teams and growing teams or fixing team performance for a very long time. So yes. I've obviously started in the military, rolled on to sales teams in the fitness world, and then into the nonprofit world, scaling volunteer teams across the Northwest, and managing teams and operations and disaster operations, you know, people coming in from all over the country, different skills, different backgrounds, and getting them to all do good for one small community. Yeah, I would say there's a lot of teamwork there.
All right, now we're going to jump over to some more personal questions.
Oh, my.
What's your, nothing was scary.
Wasn't everything else personal already?
Yeah, a lot. But I want to know your favorite foreign word. You've had exposure to a lot of languages.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know why. So I keep on bringing Ghana up, but I really loved listening to Twi. I even always struggle with making sure I say the words right. Like, it's a TWI is the language, and it's a Twi. And I think my favorite word was thank you there, medase. And I always got a little bit of a laugh from people whenever I would say medase pa, like, thank you very much. And like, they didn't, I felt like they didn't expect me to know the pa portion. But yeah, it was always one of my favorite things to say. Or chale, which is like kind of like guy or dude, you know, just a friend, like just a friendly person.
That's a good one. All right, your favorite vacation.
Favorite vacation. Oh my goodness. Are we talking about favorite food, favorite activities? There's so many things.
Place.
Cuba.
Really? Tell me why.
Yes. I like going to places that others might seem like it's an unlikely place to go to, or not too many people go to. And Cuba was like stepping back in time. It was like stepping back into the 60s in a lot of ways. Cuban people are just amazing. They're the friendliest people you can imagine. And despite what people might think about the political and social environment, I mean, just seeing how people are happy, willing to open their doors for you, and just have this, you know, the joie de vivre, like they're just happy to live and share with you whatever they have. The country is beautiful, amazingly beautiful, and then of course you can't say no to mojitos and great cigars there. But I mean,
there's and the food, the drink.
Yeah, the food, the drink, and the music. Oh my gosh, I remember because I went with a few of my friends, and we went to this little beach, and we were just hanging out by the beach, and all of a sudden I started hearing some music, and started walking down the beach, and there was these three guys that were just sitting there with their back against the sandbank, and they were just, you know, strumming on their guitar and just playing songs and drinking a cold beer by the beach. And so they saw me, and they're like, come over here. And they're like, what songs do you like? And they were just, you know, strumming along all the songs that I would throw at them, because I knew some Hispanic songs. And it was just such a great memory. And they have some amazing virgin beaches that I just hope they stay that way. And great outdoor adventure too, rock climbing, mountain biking, a lot of those things. So yeah, it was an amazing country, and I can't wait to go back.
Nice. Okay, so how about your most rewarding cross-cultural experience in work? It can be rewarding or uncomfortable or memorable.
Oh. that's a tough one. I like making memorable experiences. Memorable experiences is one. I think tough experiences, I think I've had memorable experiences, a lot of them, but tough experiences was actually working, you know, working in India, trying to, you know, work in the, or get contractors in the architecture and you know, general contracting business and lands acquisition. It's almost like it's a male dominated world. from an industry perspective. And so, again, we go back to like English as a major language, even though English is spoken in India widely. There was still a barrier there. Going into a meeting and most of them understood English, and so they would listen to you and just kind of nod and say, yeah, like showing that they understand what you're saying, but then they would just start talking in their own language, and then you're kind of left like, oh, I have no clue what they're discussing now. It was a cultural misunderstanding, and so it took some time for me to break those barriers, and also realizing that there's India, and then there are different states, and then there are different regions, and then even within those regions, there's layers upon layers of different religions, whether it's Hindu or Muslim or Christian, Catholic, right? And so, for example, on one occasion, I was about to award a contract to this guy, and he was setting me up with all these other third party contractors. And he says, we're going to take care of you. We got it all taken care of. And don't you worry about things. All my good Catholic friends are going to take care of you. And I just looked at him like, what? What do you mean? And so realized that he was awarding all the contracts, or was planning on awarding the contracts to only his Catholic Indian friends. And so I'm like, whoa, 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 we can't do that. We are all about, I'm trying to tout a Silicon Valley ideology, like, hey, we're about diversity, and we can't look like we're only favoring one side, because we're going to be, providing services to people of any religion and any, gender. It doesn't matter, right? And so it was very challenging to try and translate our company culture, not just American, culture, but American, like the company culture of my organization, into those communities. And so it's turned into, let me get to know your, family, getting invited to local dinners, getting to just tell them about why we believe the way that we believed. Why was ethical business so important? Why was, not giving in to corruption so important, when for them it doesn't matter? It's like, you're crazy, right? If you don't try to give the local official, a small bribe, it's not a bribe. It's just a way of doing business, right? And so it was, it took a lot of patience, one, to understand, look, they don't think they're wrong. I don't think I'm wrong. So where do we find that intersection where we come to the same agreement that, one, is respectful to them, and two, I'm not breaking laws, and I'm also getting what I need, right? And so it goes into relationship building, having an open mind to get to know local people, local culture, local customs, and how do they view the world, right? And actually, one of my favorite things that I wish I'd had in my pocket back then is called the Hofstede Insights. And it actually ranks different cultural, we want to call them cultural insights from different countries. For example, how do Americans view power, right? What kind of score do they have between 0 and 100? Are we very hierarchical in how we set up our companies? And is the CEO really the man or the woman and the voice of power? Or can, an employee come up and bring up dissent, right? Or can you object in a meeting? And so those things are important, right? Or knowing whether a country is more geared toward community, or whether they're more individualistic, for example. Yeah. And so realizing that in a lot of cultures, individualism is frowned upon, and it's all about community and consensus and what matters in relationships. And there's just a lot of things that Americans looking to expand overseas should not just look, okay, great, I have a great product that everybody's going to want, right? But when they're considering marketing, hiring, operations, everything, even when if they're going to bring an American manager into that country, how do people view power? How do people view decision making, right? What really matters to people there? Is it a long-term quality product, or is it a cheap product, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of those things really matter. And then I think that going in with that knowledge, and if I had had that knowledge, right? Like, for me, it was like, quick, you need to get to India and help us do this. Like, right, you've done it in Africa, you've done it in other places. So, right, I can do it there. And yes, I was able to do it. That was, I succeeded in the end, but it took a lot longer than I.
Because you had to learn about the culture. Yeah, right. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're out of time because this is a lot of valuable information. Where can people reach you if they want to work hire to work with you or to learn more or to ask you questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can always reach me at Krista, C-R-I-S-T-A, at Casas Global Solutions. That's C-A-S-A-S, globalsolutions.com. Our website is also casasglobalsolutions.com. And you can also find us on LinkedIn, either on LinkedIn, Krista Casas, or you can also look up our company name on there. So we're pretty active across the board.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much. Well, listeners, there's a lot here, and sometimes it can feel overwhelming because she was talking about a lot of different cultures and countries and learning. Yet it's a good thing to remember to narrow down that once you've picked the country you're going into, you really only need to think about the customs for that country. And the other thing that I took away today too was that a reminder, if somebody is sitting in the room with you that doesn't speak the language, don't slip into your native language and make that person feel left out. That can be very uncomfortable. So thanks so much for listening. And if you learned something today or you got a chuckle, please tell somebody about this podcast. You can share it on your favorite places to listen. Thanks so much. And we will tune in to the next guest next time. Look forward to it.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.